I'm glad you're here. We're all glad you're here. We've started a series of messages before Easter, and the message that I'm going to share with you this morning is the one that was supposed to happen on that Sunday that we didn't make it here in the snowstorm. Some of us did. I actually came here with my wife and sent three people away, I think it was. We've got a lot of sensible people in this church. You didn't try to come to church that morning, and I appreciate that. The series of messages that we're working on is entitled Gabriel Detained. Gabriel Detained. And this is part two. That's all I can takes. Can't takes no more. And you'll probably understand, I know that's not good grammar, but you'll probably understand why I chose that particular title by the time we get to the end of the message. You may remember, if you were here, whatever that was, 3 weeks ago, I guess it was, that we talked about that story that comes from Daniel chapter 10, and we kind of snuck behind enemy lines, and some things were revealed to us there that really only spies could figure out in a major battle. Gabriel, it seems it must be Gabriel, has appeared to Daniel and told him that Daniel has had this revelation, you remember, and he's wondering what it means, and so he begins to pray and fast, and 3 whole weeks goes by, and he gets no answer, and then finally this being that is so terrifying, listen to me, this being that is so terrifying that Daniel actually passes out when he sees him. And then finally ends up on his hands and knees. And when he's finally standing up, the angel says to him, "Stand up, I want to talk to you." And Daniel actually is able to just kind of gasp out, I can't even breathe, how am I supposed to talk with you? It's a great scene. I mean, it's an absolutely great scene. But this being that is so terrifying, so powerful, so awesome, so overwhelming, actually says to Daniel that I left heaven 3 weeks ago and was taken prisoner by somebody he calls the Prince of Persia, and then I was held by the King of Persia, and it isn't until Michael the Archangel comes. I mean, there's this battle going on. Battle. Right above Daniel's head, and Daniel had no idea that it was happening. We took the time to wonder what might be going on above our heads this morning. We realized as we looked at that story and began to unfold, to uncover, we tried to the best of our ability, to sneak behind enemy lines, to walk right up to the headquarters, to duck down beneath that open window and listen to these plans that are being hatched, these things that are so directed against us. Because if we could figure out what the enemy was up to, if we could figure out what his plan was, maybe we'd stand a better chance at saying no at the times we're supposed to say no, and yet maybe we could win a few. Because I don't know how you felt while you were singing this morning. Freedom reigns in this place. Amen. We want to say that, right? But I don't know how many of you stood there and thought, yeah, freedom reigns when I'm here, but when you wouldn't like me when I'm at home. Ain't no freedom there. We identify with the song we sang before that caught in the middle thing where I know there are certain things expected of me, but I don't know. I just don't, you know, even on a good day, anything's liable to happen. We're caught in the middle between what we know we're supposed to be and what we actually are, between what we want God to do for us and what God actually does for us, and between the altar and the door. Did you sang that? You heard that phrase, or you sang it? We all have those moments when we come up here to the altar and we say, God, it's going to be different. I'm telling you, God, I promise it's going to be different. And somewhere between up here and back there at that door, we lose our resolve. We lose our follow-through. And Tuesday morning and Thursday afternoon look a heck of a lot different than Sunday morning, no matter what we sing. That's why we're talking about this. That's why we're talking about enemy tactics, because if we can become aware of enemy tactics, we might begin to recognize the enemy when he comes along. We talked about in that first message, and by the way, you can go to iTunes and download it as a podcast. We talked about the anatomy of sin, the anatomy of temptation, and how it works in our lives, how it starts out as this simple little desire. I wish I had more excitement in my life. I wish I had more intimacy. I wish I had more fun. We agreed together that there's nothing wrong with feeling that way, right? I mean, everybody wants a little more excitement. But the enemy is aware of that simple desire, more excitement, more fun, more interest in life. And he actually taps into that because he knows us pretty well. And that's when he begins to suggest, hey, you know what? This isn't just a little more excitement that you're longing for. What you're looking for is that woman over there who is not your wife, I admit, but it'd be fun. Oh, you know, you could have a little more money if you just cheat on your taxes. That time is coming around. Do I need to remind you of that, you know? Well, we could, if we just went out partying with those guys, I mean, they sure seem to be having fun. And before you know it, the opportunity comes along. And we shouldn't be surprised that the enemy would carry it that far. Because we've said yes in our thinking so many times that we've come to the place now where, well, listen, you say yes in your dreams and your fantasies and your thinking over and over again. When the real opportunity comes along, what do you suppose your chances are saying no? That was the question we asked 3 weeks ago. And for a little while, I'm happy because I have what I wanted. I've got the excitement. I've got the thrill. I've got extra money in my pocket. I went to the party last night and nobody knew about it. We all came to understand as we looked at James chapter 1, that sin begins to grow itself. It's taken shape, it's given birth, it begins to grow. And as it begins to grow, it used to be the thing that you went out to get, and now it's the thing that's got you. It used to be the thing that you chased after, and now it's the thing that won't let you go. Grows to full maturity and becomes a sinful habit in my life. And I'm at a point in my life where I don't even think I can say no anymore. I've lost all control in that part of my life. And then that grows up and matures, that habit, and eventually takes over every aspect and every component of my life, and I begin to see death creeping into my marriage and death creeping into my relationship with my children and death creeping into my job. Because desire conceives and brings forth sin. Sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. That's what James says. So that's the pattern that we were talking about. And I probably should stop there because part of my time is already gone. And all I really did was tell you what I already told you. I don't need to tell you that because now we have, how many have an iPod or something that looks like an iPod? Well, there you go. Three people. Poorer group of people than I was expecting. Right now this morning, yes, because I know you're not going to raise your hand no matter what I say. How many are still breathing? See, there you go. There's a whole row right there. That is, they have passed away. Right now this morning, I want to talk to you about, are you ready for this? The most dangerous thing in the world. Oh, I'm sorry. I get carried away when that slide comes on. If I were to ask you to generate a list of the most dangerous things in the world, what would you say are the most dangerous things in the world? Maybe the three most dangerous things in the world. Let me give you some suggestions here. There's earthquakes. And I don't know, probably if you've spent your whole life in Missouri, maybe you've never been through one. I've been through earthquakes in the midst of my travels, or maybe you would say typhoons. If you've ever had the chance to go through a typhoon, and you get the chance, just let me recommend to you, just say no. Don't. You don't want to go through a typhoon, but they're pretty dangerous. Or how about this one, tsunamis? I don't know where they got this picture. I Googled it, and there it was. I mean, that looks pretty dangerous. Or how about this one? Floods. Now, you know, sometimes we have floods around here. That's actually in Metro Manila, and it's more than a nuisance. Or maybe you would say volcanoes. Volcanoes are really dangerous, right? Would you agree with that? Volcanoes are really dangerous, but we don't have too many of those around here. So I saved the best for last. I saved the one that's probably on everybody's list. Are you ready for this? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, tornadoes. The question I'm asking is, if that's a list of the most dangerous things on the planet, how would we come to the point where we could figure out which one was the most dangerous? I know for us, we're probably going to say tornadoes. That's what we build the shelters for. We don't build the shelters because we're afraid of volcanoes here in Missouri, right? We might say that it's tornadoes. Not everyone would generate the same list. But here's the question we could ask. Which of these things has killed the most people? Wouldn't that be a great way to just kind of measure it, to objectify it a little bit so that we could actually, you know, does anybody know which of those things has killed the most people? Typhoons, earthquakes, tsunamis, 225,000 killed in 2005 by a tsunami. But anybody know? You're not going to raise your hand, I know. But I'll let you in on a little secret. Floods win by a landslide. I'm sorry. It came out like that. But floods have killed more people historically than any other. And so there would be a way that we could say, since floods have killed the most people, they are categorically the most dangerous. Even though our idea of what actually is dangerous might differ, I'd like to suggest that when it comes to danger, most of us react in exactly the same way. One of two ways, that is. I remember back in 1979, if you can imagine remembering 1979, it was March of 1979, and my wife and I, Faith and I, and our little baby girl had just arrived in the Philippines. We were getting used to some new sights and new smells and new sounds and all of that, you know, when you move to another country. And I remember one of the evenings we were getting ready for bed. And as we were getting ready for bed, Faith screamed. I mean, screamed. And jumped up on the bed. So now she's standing on the bed. Well, I want to be a supportive husband, so I jumped up on the bed with her. And I looked at her and I said, "Hey, hon, we're standing on the bed." And she said, "Yep." And I said, "Why are we standing on the bed?" And she said, "Because I saw a cockroach down there." Oh, man, she used to be terrified of cockroaches. Time has passed, and cockroaches are now terrified of her. She's notorious in the cockroach world for the things that she does to cockroaches. But the point I'm trying to make, I mean, I actually looked at her and said, you know, this particular reaction, while I don't want to diminish how you feel, because feelings are, men, if you're married, feelings are just terribly important. You don't want to diminish or, you know, I said, you know, when this kind of reaction right here is for cobras, not for cockroaches, okay? You need to revise your list, girl. But the point that I'm trying to make is that when we run into something that's dangerous, we choose one of two things. We choose to either fight with it or run away from it. Fight or flight, that's what we call it. Fight or flight. When danger comes our way, we either fight with it, we deal with it, we put it down, or we run away. And so, well, we're not really done with the idea just that. We try to eliminate the danger, and if we can't, we run away, or at least typically we do. Let me try to illustrate that for you. If I were to ask you, oh, there it is, I won't do the laugh thing, but what's the most dangerous animal on earth? How about this one? Oh, he's got a nice smile, doesn't he? Everyone that I'm going to put up there, lions perhaps, or that grizzly bear right there, they kind of look like cousins, I know, but they're not. And there's a tiger there or a great white. They all look the same, right? Which one of those is the most dangerous? Of all the animals on planet Earth, which one is the most dangerous? Lions and tigers and bears. Well, we could argue that the shark wouldn't be terribly dangerous, at least here in church. You know, he would be somewhat hampered. But that looks like a dangerous group of animals. So I think we'd have to be objective again and ask the question, which one is responsible for the deaths of the most people? And I saw you earlier just whispering to each other, and I don't know if you've got a good copy of the Guinness Book of World Records, but this is actually in the Guinness Book of World Records where I read, are you ready for this? A single tiger in India killed more than 400 people. A single tiger. I hear that and I wonder to myself, if a single tiger could kill that many, how many would a married tiger kill? I mean, you know, we're grumpier after we get married for some reason. I'm just saying. Which one of them? Which is the most dangerous animal on earth? Well, I'm going to let you in on another little secret here. It's none of these. The most dangerous animal on planet Earth is right there. That's the Anopheles mosquito. They're not actually that big, just so you're not too worried about it. But the Anopheles mosquito, does anybody know what the Anopheles mosquito is notorious for? They carry malaria and transfer it from one person to the other. And what you might not have known, I mean, we'd have to ask the question, 50% of all human deaths since the beginning of recorded history that are not related to war are the result of malaria. 50% of the people who have died around the world have died of malaria. So what I'd like to suggest to you that it's amazing to me that something as seemingly harmless, something as tiny as a mosquito, an Anopheles mosquito, could be so notorious for being so deadly and so dangerous. And yet, could I suggest something to you? That when it comes to the Anopheles mosquito, if a tiger were to walk into this room with that look on his face like you saw in that picture, what do you suppose would happen to the people in this room? Flight. I don't think, there might be some men who would just try to give their friends and family an opportunity to get away, but for the most part, there would be running and screaming, right? I mean, that's really, it would be the end of this message for sure. If a tiger did that, even if there was a shark, I mean, great white shark the size of a Volkswagen laying there, and we wouldn't be going close to it. There'd be running and screaming. But when a mosquito flies into the room, I'm not suggesting that you run and scream when a mosquito flies into the room, because you'd have more explaining to do than I'm doing right now, but isn't that odd? And in spite of the fact that the Anopheles mosquito, and I've been lots of places where there are Anopheles mosquitoes, in spite of the fact that they are unquestionably more dangerous and have caused more death, we just kind of, we wave it off. Well, floods may be the most dangerous natural disaster, and the mosquito may be the most dangerous animal, but neither of those is the most dangerous thing if we use the same measurement. The Anopheles mosquito is responsible for the deaths of half of all the people that have died, but it still isn't the most deadly thing. To find out what is the most dangerous thing on earth, we'd have to ask what has caused the death of more people than anything else. And the answer to that question is found in Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. What that's saying is these little habits that we have, these little things that we tend to excuse, these little things that we tend to just kind of pass over. It's that sin, that disobedience, that breakdown in your life and in mine. It's that's caused the death of every human being there is, because all have sinned. Sin has caused the death of every single human being since the world began. But like the mosquito, like the Anopheles mosquito, sin seems harmless and of no real consequence. We wave off mosquitoes. What happens to fight or flight when it comes to mosquitoes? Well, we just take a pass on that. What happens to fight or flight when temptation comes walking into the room? And temptation walks into the room. Opportunity may knock, but temptation breaks the door down. Have you noticed that? What happens when I'm faced with temptation? Now, I'm not suggesting you run away screaming from the mosquito, but we do battle malaria, don't we, if you're living in a place where it's prevalent? And I'm not suggesting that you run screaming out of the room when temptation comes to visit, but I am suggesting that you and I learn to do battle with sin. That we begin to recognize how dangerous it is, but sometimes we just don't. Have you ever noticed in your own life how much easier you are on yourself with your bad habits than you are with other people? You notice that? You ever heard yourself say, I'm sorry, that's just the way I am. I mean, I know I was really angry, and I know I really hurt your feelings, Mike, but it's just the way I am. Or how about this one? I can't help it. Yeah, I know that you're probably just really, but I can't. Or how about this one? It's no big deal. Come on. In the larger scheme of things, I'm a pretty good guy, right? So I've got this little habit of, it's no big deal. That is the spiritual equivalent of, yeah, I've realized it's a nuisance, but doggone it. You ever allowed yourself any of those excuses? Could it be that we haven't come to terms with how dangerous sin really is? Is that the problem? I mean, if it feels good, do it. That's where our society is. But, you know, there's a story from God's Word that illustrates how dangerous sin is. Well, I mean, there's a bunch of them. But the first one that comes to mind, you may recognize these guys. There they are. I'll give you a hint. They're brothers, and one is killing the other. Can anybody? I don't know who drew this picture of Cain and Abel, but I'm very thankful that they did, because it forever answers the eternal question, boxers or briefs. I mean, now we know, right? Had he not drawn that picture, and clearly the first result of the fall of man was that men begin to wear satin underwear. But we don't need to go into that. I don't want you to be distracted by the picture. That's Cain, and he's killing Abel. And, well, it comes from Genesis chapter 4, if you have your Bibles and want to follow along. But I'm just going to make them go away for now, if you don't mind, because it's very distracting. This is the story from God's Word. Immediately after the fall of man, Adam and Eve were together, quite naturally, and the result of their being together was that she conceived. 9 months later, she gave birth to a son, and she called him Cain, saying, "The Lord has given me a man in answer to the promise he made to me." Not too long after that, she gave birth to his brother, Abel. Well, as they grew, Abel became a guy who took care of sheep. He was like a rancher. And Cain became a farmer. He tilled the soil. He produced vegetables and fruit. And it happened that both of them got the idea one day that they would bring an offering to the Lord. Well, Cain brought an offering of vegetables, fruit and grain and stuff that he had grown in the garden. And Abel brought an offering that came from the best portions of the firstborn lambs in his flock. God looked at the offering that Abel had brought, the lamb, and, well, he was quite pleased with it and pleased with Abel as a consequence of that. But he also then looked at the offering that Cain had brought, and he wasn't pleased with that. And I'm here to tell you right now, Cain was ticked. You could see it on his face. So God spoke to Cain, and he said, "Cain, why are you so angry? And what's this look on your face? If you do the right thing, I'll accept you. But I'm warning you, Cain, if you don't do the right thing, sin is crouching at your door. You must do battle with it and control it, because if you don't, it will have you. It desires to have you." Cain, not too long after that, said to his brother Abel, "Hey, let's just go for a little walk in the field out there. You know, it's something I'd like to show you." When they got out there in the field, Cain killed his brother Abel. Hit his body in the sand. As he was making his way back to where he was staying, God stopped him and spoke to him and said, "Cain, where's your brother Abel?" "I don't know," Cain said. "Am I supposed to be babysitting my brother? What is this?" "Cain, what have you done?" God said. "Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, where you spilled it. And now I'm telling you, Cain, from now on you will till the ground, but it will never produce for you like it has in the past. The ground that received your brother's blood will no longer produce crops for you, And Cain, you will go out from here and be a restless wanderer on planet Earth. And that is the story from God's Word. One of the oldest stories in recorded history. It marks the first time God spoke to a man after the fall. God has a very specific warning for Cain. I hope you heard it. He speaks of sin. God speaks of sin as though it's a living thing, a vicious, wild animal that might attack at any moment. Did you catch it? He actually says, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. And if you conjure up the picture that in your mind that God is painting for us, it makes sin seem like a very dangerous thing. Something that desires to have us. Something that we have to learn to do battle with. Remarkably, in that first story, the very first story we hear about man is Genesis chapter 3, the fall of man, and in that story, somebody sins. The story of Cain and Abel is the second story that we hear about man, and in that story, somebody dies. Somebody sins, somebody dies. Somebody sins, somebody dies. I hope you're aware, just so we understand our place in all of this, I hope you're aware that there are two kingdoms. That's what that actually says. It's peeking at us. I hope you're aware that there are two kingdoms on planet Earth. One is called the kingdom of light and goodness, and the other is called the kingdom of evil and darkness. Two kingdoms. This two-kingdom principle actually started with Cain and Abel. Cain, who went away from God, Abel, who followed God. Abel's dead, and now Seth has been born, and Seth becomes the one who follows God. Seth and his descendants follow God. Well, the head of the kingdom of light and goodness is God, and the head of the kingdom of evil and darkness is Satan. We know that. When we say it like that, though, when we put it on a chart like that, we could get the idea that Satan is God's rival. Have you ever heard it's phrased like that? Satan is God's rival? Can I suggest something to you this morning? Satan is God's enemy. He is not God's rival. We need to be very clear about that. Because when we talk about a rival, you know, this chocolate cake rivals that chocolate cake. There's kind of an equality there. This team, Lebanon, rivals that team. Yeah, okay, so you are tracking. It rivals Camden. This army rivals that army. This school rivals. And what we mean is that on any given day, all things being equal, either one could emerge the victor. We don't like it when Lebanon wins. If you're from Lebanon, forgive me that for that, but they'll hurt me later if I don't say that. Sometimes Lebanon wins, sometimes Camdenton wins. But Satan and God are not rivals. God has enemies, but he has no rival. The closest thing Satan has to a rival would be Michael the archangel. We learn that from Daniel chapter 10. And then there's angels that find their rivals in the demons. And, well, if we've got to click it one more time, because that's where we find ourselves. We find ourselves as either part of the kingdom of light and darkness or the kingdom of light or the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of good or the kingdom of evil. And no, your picture's not up there, so don't look for it. If it is, forgive me. I found it on the internet. You and I are part of a kingdom today. So without being really conceited about this, those who are part of the kingdom of light draw their resources from God. And those who are part of the kingdom of darkness draw their resources from God's enemy, Satan. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I want us to understand that when it comes to your battle with sin, do you know what it means to be part of the kingdom of light this morning? It means that the power and resources that you and I have at our disposal are infinitely greater than what Satan has at his disposal. And I know it doesn't feel that way sometimes, but it is. I've always loved the image that we paint of the Lord Jesus as a tiny baby there in the manger. And we looked at that story over Christmas time, and it's an absolutely beautiful story. But I want you to understand that the baby of the manger could never have done what God the Father sent him to do. The babe left the manger and became the Christ of the cross. That's what we celebrated last week. He was crucified, he was buried, and he rose again. And we need to understand that Christ defeated Satan once and for all at the cross. The battle has been won. And that's why we say that the power and resources that you have at your disposal are infinitely greater than what Satan has at his disposal. Because that's how it works with light and darkness. You've noticed this, right? Work with me here. Some of you have children and you put them to bed. You do put them to bed, right? Go to bed, I'm watching CSI. I know, but you put them to bed. And when CSI is over, you say to yourself, it's pretty quiet, I better go check on them, right? And so you walk down that long hallway where the light is on and the light is off in your kid's room. Have you ever noticed how when you open that door just a crack to look in at your kid, have you noticed how the darkness just streams across the lighted hallway, just streams out of that dark room across? You ever noticed that? No, you haven't. Stop nodding your heads at me. No, you haven't. Some of you will fall for anything. No! When you open the door just to crack, the light from the hallway floods into the dark bedroom, doesn't it? Because that's the nature of light and darkness. John actually wrote that the light has shined in the darkness and the darkness has never overcome it. That's the nature of being part of the kingdom of light. So Satan is the underdog in this fight with us. I know it doesn't feel that way, but he is. That's the honest to God truth. He's the underdog. You know, last football season, the New England Patriots, which is my team, because I grew up in Massachusetts, and I apologize for not being a great fan of Kansas City, but the New England Patriots, on a particular day, we're actually going to play the Dallas Cowboys, and my wife and I love to watch football, and it was going to be broadcast down here, and so we decided we were going to watch the game. And while we wanted to go for a walk because it was a beautiful afternoon, so we, you know, I pushed record on DirecTV, and then we went for our walk, and we came home, and we got some supper, and we sat down to watch, and the New England Patriots were playing terribly. I mean, the defense, it was like they forgot to come out of the locker room or something. I don't know what was going on, but they were just, the Patriots were being trounced by the Dallas Cowboys. And Faith kept saying, you know, if they don't get busy here. Well, halftime comes, and so she gets up, and she's going to get us both a drink, and she's out in the kitchen, you know. And I thought to myself, I'd really like to know how the Detroit Lions did today, because that's my son-in-law's team. And so I hit that little thing on the right, you know, with DirecTV, and the very first thing that came up was this. Patriots 20, Cowboys 16, final. Whoa! I clicked off so that I couldn't see it anymore, and I made it go away, and Faith came back out. She didn't see it. You know, the Patriots, they're playing terrible. Third quarter was just as nasty as the other two. Fourth quarter, they maybe rummaged around a little bit, but with less than a minute left to play, the Patriots were down 16-13. And Faith kept saying, yeah, they're not going to win this one. And I kept saying, honey, they're going to win it. I'm telling you right now, they're going to win it. I don't know. They don't see. Whoa! She says, as Tom Brady got up and did the thing that Tom Brady does so well and threw one of those, and, you know, the guy, and Wes Welker, who no longer plays with the, hey, stop that right now. There's a Denver fan, and I'll explain that to you later. But by the end of the game, there was the score. Patriots 20, Cowboys 16. And Faith sat there, and she said, boy, she said, you know, I didn't think they were going to win, but you never lost faith in them. And she's working this morning, so I still don't know if she knows this part of the story. But I was able to say, well, hey, it's Patriots. What does that have to do with it? I just got to check my notes. Hey, what I'm trying to say with this is the Bible's a big book. Do you agree with that? It's a big book, and it's full of all kinds of stuff, and it doesn't always feel like the good guys are coming out on top, does it? But can I tell you something? I read the end of the book. I snuck a peek. And here's the deal. We win.
Woo!
The kingdom of light will triumph over the kingdom of darkness. That's the truth. So what I'm trying to say this morning, and I realize time is running away, what I'm trying to say this morning is that you have resources you know nothing about. You and I, we have resources. I ran across, here's the deal. We win because we're not fighting to win. We're fighting to maintain the victory that Christ has already won for us over the kingdom of darkness. I read a quote the other day that just says it. Christians today are like deep sea divers who wear equipment that's designed to withstand tremendous depths and immense pressures. And while wearing that equipment, they march bravely to pull the plugs from their bathtubs. That's what we do. We're suited up. We've been given resources and power. We have the opportunity to look the enemy in the eye and say, no. I'm not falling for this again. I'm not falling for this anymore. But instead of doing that, we wear all this equipment to pull the plugs from our bathtubs. We're missing out. We're missing out. Oh my goodness. Our time is almost up. I'm just going to take a couple more minutes here. Remember when I told the story of Daniel and the angel? I don't know how many of you thought to yourself, I wonder why God didn't just move Satan out of the way so the angel could get there. Has that occurred to you? I mean, while we're at it, why doesn't God just like take away our old nature, our sinful nature, so that we can get things right once in a while? Why doesn't he get the enemy out of our way? Why doesn't he make him, why on earth would he leave us here to fight battles like he has? I'm going to tell you, you ready for this? You can write this down. Why? Because God doesn't want puppets he can play with. He doesn't want you to be a puppet that he can play with. He wants men and women and children and young people who obey him simply because he doesn't want that. Well, you know, I don't have the ability to disobey, and so that's why I obey you. Whoopee! Here's what he wants. He wants men and women who are free to choose to sin if they want to sin, but who willingly choose instead to obey him because they love him. That's what he wants. When you and I willingly choose to obey God, we bring great glory to him. Okay, one more thing, and I'm done. How many of you here know who Popeye is? You know who Popeye is? You know who Popeye is, right? Popeye's that guy with the great big forearms and no biceps at all, and he appears in a lot of cartoons, and I don't know whether he can see or not see, but he always has that corncob pipe, and he's generally strong to the finish when under the right circumstances, but he has a rival. He has an enemy named Brutus or Bluto. It depends on which cartoon you're watching, and I don't know why they change the names around just to confuse children, I'm sure. It's a left or right wing, I don't know what it is. But you know how it works. Bluto is always, both of these guys are in love with the anatomically improbable olive oil, and on any given day, one of them is going to have her attention, right? I mean, that's what they do, and then it isn't long before a fight breaks out, and Bluto just beats the snot out of Popeye. I don't know if I can say that in church, but he does. That's what he throws houses at him and airplanes and all kinds of stuff. And finally, Bluto or Brutus will throw olive oil over his shoulder, and that's when you hear the, oh, Popeye, you know? And here's my favorite part. As soon as he does that, as soon as Brutus starts to take off with olive oil, Popeye says, maybe you could even say it with me, that's all I can takes, I can't takes no more. And he uses his corncob pipe as a blowtorch, and he opens his spinach, and he eats his spinach, and you know, beats the living. It happens the same way every time, but I still like watching the cartoons. Never once has Brutus actually won when Popeye gets in touch with why it is that he's strong to the finish. Popeye the Sailor Man, I'm strong to the finish because I eats me spinach. I know it's grammatically incorrect, but that's all I'm trying to say this morning. It's all I can take. That's my wish for you today. I wish for me that we'd start taking the battle back into the enemy's face. That we'd look him in the eye, not out of a sense of conceit, but because we know how the story ends, that we would look him in the eye and say no. And I'm going to give you some permission, okay? You can actually say hell no if you want to, because that's a Bible word. It is. It's a Bible word. But to look him in the eye and say no. I know how this turns out. I know where this goes. I know where you're taking me. I'm not going to go with you this time. You sang that song earlier, and I'm going to ask the band to come up, but I want you to hear these words. Casting Crowns sings it, somewhere between the hot and the cold, somewhere between the new and the old, somewhere between who I am and who I used to be, somewhere in the middle you'll find me. Somewhere between the wrong and the right, somewhere between the darkness and the light, somewhere between who I was and who you're making me, somewhere in the middle you'll find me. Somewhere between my heart and my hands, somewhere between my faith and my plans, somewhere between the safety of the boat and the crashing waves, somewhere between a whisper and a roar, somewhere between the altar and the door. Somewhere between contented peace and always wanting more, somewhere in the middle, you'll find me. Just how close can I get, Lord, to my surrender without losing all control? We're fearless warriors in a picket fence with reckless abandon wrapped in common sense and deep water faith in the shallow end, and we are caught in the middle. With eyes wide open to the differences, the God we want and the God who is, but will we trade our dreams for His? Or are we caught in the middle?